Before I joined the Marine Corps, I thought that going to war would probably bring a peaceful solution in Iraq, but I have to quote a bumper sticker that says, war for peace is like, I won't continue it, but I'm sure you all know what I'm talking about. This is a tough subject for me to talk about, sorry. This war has not been beneficial to anybody on either side. And the sad fact is the effects of this war are going to continue past our generation. And you might think that just ending the war in Iraq would be the end of the problem, but American sentiment is an all-time low. And I don't think any of us ever would have thought that this could have been where our country was heading just several years ago. I'd also like to point out that when you have military members fighting a war without a mission, that becomes experience, and in the future they'll build off that experience. And since I was able to serve in Iraq and Afghanistan, two completely different situations, I saw members carry over lessons they learned in Iraq into Afghanistan that were not right for the situation. Where this continues is that if the Iraq war is ended, we could face the same mistakes that we're making now because of the experience we build off of, unless we are able to expose that experience as being wrong. And that's what impeachment is about. It's about exposing those lies. It's about bringing to light the truth. The American people deserve it. They demand nothing less. I wish I could say I have the answer, you know, the shortcut to get to the end of this war and how to make yourself more effective. But I think one of the big steps is getting those you know around you involved. And I can say from personal experience, because I have family members that are not exactly online with my views, that I will never stop trying to get them to look at this war the way I do. And every time, whether it be Thanksgiving dinner or just meeting up to say hi, somehow this war comes up because there's something in me that knows it's wrong. And that's where I go back to my first statement, that even if this war was legal, that's not good enough. Because it right here, right in the gut, I think we all know it's wrong. We all know we've been lied to. And some of us, most of us here have probably admitted that, well, I can say I ate the cake. I believe that all the lies, you know, before the invasion. But something right here just started saying, you know, what are we doing here? You know, if this was legal and what we're doing was so right, why does it feel so wrong? Why do I think about it so much? Why do I continue to think about it? I've almost been out 2 years, and, you know, they say, oh, I think about this every day. I think about it every minute. I wish I could get some free time. Until I slept purposely for this event, I had been up for 2.5 days. Why? Not because I was worried about this event, but I am out there giving my all, trying to end this war. This is actually really important to me because it's about reaching out and networking to people that haven't been exposed. I'm going to give you our chapter phone number. This phone number will either get a voicemail that one of us will check immediately, or it will reach one of our members right here in Rochester. We're going to be traveling down to D.C. tomorrow to get some training through IVAW to help out returning veterans with problems they might be facing. So if you just need somebody to chat with, we're going to be driving for 6 hours. So feel free to call us or leave us a message. The number is 585-563-2074. And the reason I want to say this number is important is because I was in Rochester for almost 8 months before I knew IVAW existed. But perhaps if one of my family members had passed this number along to me, I might have called it. I just want to let you know that we are for supporting the troops. No questions. Doesn't matter your political stance, your stance on the war. We will support you in every way we can. Whether you're in uniform, out of uniform, a veteran, or thinking about going in, we're going to give you all the information we can to help you through this process. Thank you.
And that was Brian Kassler, an organizer with the Rochester chapter of Iraq Veterans Against the War. You're listening to a town hall on the legality of the Iraq invasion with Scott Ritter, Elizabeth de la Vega, Brian Kassler, Kathy Castagna, and residents of the Rochester, New York area held on March 6, 2008. Coming up, discussion and reports on constituents' experience with their local Congress members. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Here's Declaration of Peace's Kathy Castagna.
This is our legislators' response time of our program. And we were going to do little cutouts, but we decided that was fine. There they are. And I just want to share with you a process that we've been in since December in trying to get them to respond to us on this question of illegality. And our group actually strategized that we would go into their offices politely with a letter and with questions about the illegality of the war. And we, when possible, formed teams that did this for 2 months. And we brought with us a position paper that we wrote and a letter that we wrote that each of the teams could modify if they want or use it as it was. It was sort of a template for them to ask our legislators to please give us a response. We needed a response. I want to read you the letter. Dear Senator, Representative, whatever, Rochester Declaration of Peace Affinity Group is seeking a clear statement from each of our congressional representatives regarding the legality of the Iraq war and occupation. And we had in bold letters, is the war in Iraq legal or illegal? We appreciate any thoughts and background information you may wish to include, but most importantly, we're interested in a simple legal or illegal response from you to describe the war and occupation. Thank you in advance for answering our inquiry on your view of the legality of the Iraq war and occupation. Attached is a position paper from our group on this issue. So what I'm going to do now is invite up all the people who did this with us. There was teams of constituents in each of the areas. So if all the people who were parts of those teams could come up here, I think it's really important that you see this group of people who did this. And then we'll have some of them share what happened. So for brevity, we're going to leave out the senators' visits. We're just going to do the House representatives' visits. And we're going to start with Louise Slaughter's visit, and Mary Adams will share that experience.
Hello. Louise Slaughter is especially important to us because she does have a reputation as being a progressive in our community. In fact, many of you have worked probably to get her elected. Many of you have supported her and respect her legislative accomplishments over the years. The other thing to know about Louise Slaughter is that in 2006, when the Democrats did take a slight majority of Congress, she was elevated to the position of the chair of the Rules Committee, which is a very powerful position, as most of you know, that's somewhat of a gatekeeping position to legislation. In looking at her record regarding war legislation, war funding, You can see that she's actually used that position to block some of the more truly progressive attempts to stop funding the war. For example, she has blocked legislation that was introduced by Representative Lee and others. So that's why we care about Louise. Here we are in this district. She's got a progressive reputation. She's in a very powerful position. So it's our job, really, to hold her accountable and have her stand up for her progressive reputation. What we found is that the circumstances that we're in now, I mean, we have vary in our positions on how well legislative process works. Some of us have more faith in the system than others. But what we found is that it is a very valuable exercise to go through the lobbying, the visiting process. And it started back before the legality campaign with visits to her staff's office. They're always very friendly with us. We visited and we've remembered war dead and victims of the Iraq War through vigiling in her office. That was actually not welcomed anymore after several times. So then we began some weekly vigiling outside of the federal building every Friday that some of you have participated in. But the more recent campaign, this legality issue, what is the point in insisting on an answer? Is it legal or illegal? The reason it's important is because the implications, if this war is indeed illegal, which it is, then we cannot allow further funding for it, no more funding at all. And as chair of the Rules Committee, she could have an instrumental position in blocking further funding. The other major reason is because it would require the beginning of the impeachment proceedings, the hearings, the investigation. And Louise Slaughter has persistently blocked that process. And she's told our group repeatedly so, and I'm sure many of you as constituents have received that message from her as well. So what does she have to say about legality? After several visits and back and forth, she did relay an oral message to us through her staff that the war is legal. And it is legal because Congress voted for it and authorized it. So that's where we at. That's where we're at with Louise Slaughter's position on the legality of the war. And we really do wish that she or her staff could be here, too, to really engage this rationale because it's a critical issue. So I'd be happy to talk with other people. I know a lot of people in the room are Slaughter's constituents. So we want to open this dialogue and keep it going.
Thank you, Mary. The next one is Randy Kuhl's office, and Sam Fedeli will speak to that one.
They're all dirty.
The audience already knows the answer. Well, on December 6th of last year, Tim Minard and Paula Hansen and myself paid a visit to the Fairport office of Randy Kuhl. And many of you know he's the rep of the 29th District. We were escorted into a conference room very politely, and I think the three of us had all been there before, and we were each given a couple minutes to speak. And we spoke from the heart. We talked about our careers, our families, and the community service that we do. And then we each took a little bit of time to talk about our own perspectives and the legality of the invasion and occupation. And then we talked, well, we each tried to summarize in our own words the position paper that the Declaration of Peace had put together. And we asked the staffer, who we didn't speak to Randy Kuhl, we asked the staffer to please go to Mr. Kuhl with our questions and give us a written reply. Okay. When the meeting was over, we got together. And it was our sense that we had really connected with the staffer. We saw it in her eyes. And during the meeting itself, she took meticulous notes and promised us that she would go to Mr. Kuhl and deliver our message. And I'm sure she did. Well, 3 months ago to this date was that meeting, and we have not received a response from Randy Kuhl, nor have we even received an acknowledgement that the meeting took place. No. Do I look surprised? Do members out there of the 29th look surprised? No. And that is why this November, we're going to have a choice. And between now and November, I'm going to personally spend a lot of my time to swap out Randy Kuhl for Eric Massa.
Okay, Carol Manuel, and you were with Reynolds.
How many out there have Mr. Reynolds as a representative? We have a few out there. Well, I'm sort of the new kid on the block here in this area. My husband and I moved here from the Commonwealth of Virginia back in September. We'd been living there for 40 years, and we came up here because we like snow, among other things. And I immediately got on the computer to find out where are the peace people, because this is one of my occupations when I was living in Virginia. And somehow, by luck, I was connected with Declaration of Peace members. And, well, about 3 weeks after we got here, we received a letter in the mail from Congressman Reynolds. And he wanted my husband and I to know that he was most happy that we had chosen to move here and to welcome us to the area, and that if there was anything that he could do to please contact his office, and he would be happy to help us and wanted us to feel welcome in Rochester. Well, as luck would have it, about 3 weeks later, I did have something I needed to ask him and some help from him, because I was asked to write a letter to him and become involved in the project about the legal or illegal war. So I thought, well, this is very providential, because I will be able to give him a chance to really make good on his offer. And I really wish he'd come tonight, because to tell you the end of the story before I tell you the in-between, I've never seen the man. So I would wish he was over there, because then I could actually meet him. But efforts were made. There was an appointment scheduled for me to meet him face-to-face. That appointment was canceled, which I'm sure happens for good reasons. But another attempt to make an appointment was just too difficult, and no time seemed right. So in frustration, I just attached the letter to the door of the office. Conley and myself went over one day unannounced just to give them the letter so at least they would have it. And even though the office door was locked, there were lights on, coats hanging up as if there were people there, but nobody came to the door. So we just attached the letter and left, and checked back later, and the letter had been removed. We also faxed a copy of the letter to his offices in Washington. So that's my story. There hasn't been any interest at all shown from Congressman Reynolds on even having the courtesy of responding to my question in letter form.
And the last one is Walsh, and that was Bruce Pease and his wife Sandy.
I might say I work in Mr. Cool's district, so I did write him a letter earlier in the summer, and I did get a response 6 months later, and I received it the day before it was dated. I'm not sure. My wife wrote to Congressman Walsh, and then I saw him at a later date. I'll read the letter that she got in response from Congressman Walsh. Dear Sandra, please see the below response to your request for background information regarding the legal aspects of the Operation Iraqi Freedom. Under Article 2, Section 2 of the United States Constitution, quote, "The President shall be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and the militia of the several states when called into action and actual service of the United States." Under Section 3 of the War Powers Act, 1973, Public Law 93-198, 93rd Congress, House Joint Resolution 542, November 7th of 1973, quote, "The President, in every possible instance, shall consult with Congress before introducing United States armed forces into hostilities or into a situation where imminent involvement in hostilities is clearly indicated by the circumstances, and after every such introduction shall consult regularly with the Congress until United States armed forces are no longer engaged in hostilities or have been removed from such situations," end quote. On October 10th, 2002, the House of Representatives passed House Joint Resolution 114, Authorization for Use of Military Force Against Iraq, Resolution of 2002. On October 11th, 2002, the Senate passed House Joint Resolution 114. On October 16th, 2002, the President signed House Joint Resolution 114 into law, Public Law Number 107-243. Below is a summary of House Joint Resolution 114. Authorization for Use of Military Force Against Iraq, Resolution of 2002, expresses support for the President's efforts to, 1, strictly enforce through the United Nations Security Council all relevant Security Council resolutions regarding Iraq, and 2, obtain prompt and decisive action by the Security Council to ensure that Iraq abandons its strategy of delay, evasion, and noncompliance of promptly and strictly complies and strictly complies with all relevant Security Council resolutions. Authorizes the President to use the United States Armed Forces to, 1, defend the United States national security against the continuing threat posed by Iraq, and 2, enforce all relevant Security Council resolutions regarding Iraq. Directs the President prior to, or as soon as possible, but no later than 48 hours, after exercising such authority, to make available to the Speaker of the House of Representatives and the President pro tem of the Senate his determination that, 1, reliance on further diplomatic or peaceful means alone will not achieve the above purposes, and 2, acting pursuant to this joint resolution, 2, consistent and is consistent with the United States and other countries, continuing to take necessary actions against international terrorists and terrorist organizations, including those who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, declares that this action is intended to constitute specific statutory authorization for use of the armed forces consistent with requirements of the War Powers Resolution, requires the President to report to Congress to at least every 60 days on matters relevant to this resolution. I hope this information is useful to you and your group as it relates to your question of legality of Operation Iraqi Freedom. Sincerely, J.T. Walsh, Member of Congress. I then visited Mr. Walsh on one of his visits to Palmyra, New York, in Wayne County, not long after this, and faced him very close, nose to nose, and said, "Mr. Congressman Walsh, is Operation Iraqi Freedom a legal war?" "Yes, it is." And I said, "Well, what verification can you give me, or how do you back that up?" He said, "I don't have to answer that. I answered your question. Next." Thank you.
So this process begs the question about accountability of our leaders. Here are constituents who have gone in good faith to defend the Constitution of the U.S. and ask for accountability. So what all of us need to be doing here is thinking about our next steps, our vision, and our actions that will be a follow-up. This isn't just a one-time event. There's a next step. So I just want us to appreciate this incredibly wonderful group of people. For the sake of time, we did not do our senators, but guess what? We didn't hear anything back from them. So I'd like us now to give the panel a chance to respond to the two responses that we did get, which was the message from Slaughter's office and that response that was just read to you by Walsh's office, and then we'll open this up. So if any of our panel would like to respond to what our responses were, that would be really helpful to us as our next step.
Well, I think you all know what the answer is. Saying that the war is legal because Congress voted for it and authorized it doesn't answer the question at all. It begs the question in the logical sense. The question is, number one, did we have do we have justification under international law? We didn't. So Congress, just on that basis alone, can't just authorize something. Under the Constitution, our treaties are the supreme law of the land. We are parties to the UN Charter, and the UN Charter does not provide for preemptive war. So that's one problem. Another problem is that the authorization itself was obtained through fraud. So the fact that they voted on it doesn't mean anything. So there you go.
I think it made it clear I'm not a lawyer. I am an American citizen, and I'm somebody who believes that an elected official has a duty and responsibility to serve those who are in the respective district, their constituents. I'd like to know how many sons and daughters of these fine representatives have gone off to war in service of a conflict they find illegal. And if I were a parent or a relative, a loved one of one of these wonderful men and women who serve our country so proudly, I'd like to have the moral and intellectual curiosity to dig a little deeper than simply a yes or no answer on legality. I'd like to know what process my respective representative engaged in making that determination. I'd like to know what questions they asked. And if I were denied an answer, that, of course, is unacceptable, because at the end of the day, they work for me. And I would not accept this answer. And I would make it my mission to pursue them to the gates of hell, if necessary, and beyond. Because a politician who is willing to rubber stamp a conflict that's measured in the blood of Americans belonging to their constituents and not willing to ask the questions to determine whether or not this war is in fact worthy of this sacrifice is a politician who is operating in dereliction of their duty and no longer deserves the honor and privilege of representing their constituents.
So now it's your turn. Would you like to go first?
Yes. We all can see that this war seems to be about money and power and special interest. But one thing I haven't heard addressed in some years is China's interest in the Middle East oil. And do you feel that the powers to be have used that to justify some of their actions in the Middle East to prevent China from going through Afghanistan? And
There's no doubt in my mind. I've made this clear that this is a war that's derived from a national security strategy that's based upon the premise that the United States will step into the vacuum created by the collapse of the Soviet Union to ensure that no nation or group of nations ever again confronts us as equals. A key element to this, of course, is to find a way to manage the problem of the world's two largest developing economies, China and India, economies that require sustained access to energy coming from the Middle East and Central Asia. And a key aspect of the strategy of the United States is to impose its will on all producing regions so that the pace of economic development can be dictated by the United States to its unilateral advantage. This is a statement of fact. Even the administration will not deny this. This is the strategic goal and objective of the United States of America. Why we should think otherwise is beyond me.
Thank you.
Yeah. The day after the invasion began, I saw Donald Rumsfeld on television say that there had been examples of the weapons of mass destruction collected and that they were being sent over to the United States. So I followed very carefully the next day the news and the day after that, waiting, wondering, you know, what mode of transportation they were using. And I'm wondering, it was never covered. And I'm wondering why the media in the United States hasn't followed up on things like this, if you have any ideas, why they haven't shared in the responsibility for this war?
I'm afraid I'm a little jet-lagged right now, but I can't think of a single reason why the media hasn't done it, except for the fact that, well, I guess I can. I can think of many. They are totally in bed with the administration. And not just the Republicans. They're totally in bed with the entire both political parties. And the reason that we have all this campaign spending is that it all ends up going to the media. So nobody has an interest in doing anything that's going to rock the boat. And they have completely let us down in every single way. And if it weren't for internet websites and so-called, bloggers, exactly, we really would know almost nothing. Certainly the even supposed newspaper like the New York Times hasn't even come close to doing the right thing. So you're absolutely right. The media is a big part of this problem, and we have to be the media.
You know, one thing that I've been able to see pretty clearly is that the media made it unpatriotic to ask questions.
Mm.
And they didn't have the guts to do it themselves.
One of the things that has been, I guess, really clear to me tonight is the importance and power of truth and the way the disregard and violation of truth got us where we are. And I guess I would say that never in this nation's history has it really faced the truth of all the wars it's participated in, from the genocide of the Native Americans to Vietnam to where we are now. I think the Winter Soldier is certainly a great step to bring out this kind of truth. And impeachment hearings would certainly be another great case. I wanted to, I guess I've been thinking about lately another couple of possibilities. War crime tribunals, which other top national leaders of other countries that have committed these kinds of crimes have been brought before. And the model of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. I wonder if any of the panelists have any comments on those.
Thanks. The prosecutor can correct me on this one, but I think in order to move forward and in accordance with the rule of law, there has to be law that in fact, constitutes a mandate, a legally binding mandate. And you're not going to find in American law the notion of a Truth and Reconciliation Committee. The International Criminal Court does not have jurisdiction. The bottom line is it's not about having others hold our problem, solve our problems for us. It's about using the force of American law to hold American criminals accountable for their acts in America. That's what we should be talking about, not turning to other people to do the job for us.
Well, I just want to say we're not members of the International Criminal Court for the very reason that the Bush administration did not want us to be held accountable. There is universal jurisdiction over many war crimes, and it is theoretically possible that some other country could attempt to hold one of our administration officials accountable for war crimes, including torture. But there have been some cases that have been attempted to be brought in Germany and Spain, and I think there's still one pending in Italy, but they have not proceeded because they take the position that there has to be a failure of the domestic law, and so you just go around and around and around.
Okay, Mike?
My comment is I don't think it's a great mystery how we solve some of the problems that we're talking about here tonight. I really don't. I don't really care who is elected president as long as it's not the Republican McCain or Hillary Clinton, you know. But I don't see it as relevant. What I see as relevant is the people you have elected to represent you are not representing you. And if you don't get good and damn mad about it and start doing something about it and visiting their office and they are sick of our faces, then we've invited ourselves to keep this problem unsolved. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
both Scott and Elizabeth alluded to the fact that, Scott mentioned that Colin Powell lied at the UN presentation by holding up a vial of powdered anthrax, which apparently, if I understood you correctly, Scott, Iraq never had. They may have had it in a liquid form, but not in the powdered form. What other lies are you aware of, either one of you, that Colin Powell or anybody else that really orchestrated this? And I also would like to know if you personally, Scott, briefed Senator Schumer, Clinton. I know you mentioned that you briefed Clinton staff, and also Representative Reynolds, because they're my representatives, and I want to know that. Thank you.
Well, as to just an example of another lie on the part of Colin Powell, I talked about the aluminum tubes before. The two main agencies that were providing specific information about why those tubes were not suitable for use in a nuclear centrifuge were the Department of Energy and the Department of State. The Department of State, of course, those agents were Colin Powell's own subordinates. And they had made it very clear to him, the information was not only available in these reports, but there were other reports that were going directly to him saying that these tubes were not suitable. Yet when he went up in front of the UN, in front of the entire world, he said, acknowledging that he was aware of the problem with what he was saying, he said, and another fact I hadn't mentioned before was that the tubes specifically matched the specifications for tubes that were used in these Medusa rockets that they knew the Iraqis were making. He said, some people, including the Iraqis, say that these tubes are used for rockets. So not only he acknowledged that he knew about this debate, and then he intentionally lumped his own experts, his own employees and subordinates, in with the Iraqis as a way of denigrating the entire idea, knowing full well what the evidence was regarding those. It was a dismal, dismal day for Colin Powell, and I'm sure for the people in the State Department.
Just a short, let's put it this way. I was in Japan when he gave his presentation. I just finished a presentation for the Japanese Parliament trying to convince them not to support the war. And I was making a presentation before the International Press Club of Tokyo, and we delayed it so I could watch Powell's speech. And long story short, every point he made was demonstrably refutable, and I refuted it. I contradicted everything based upon the available body of data that I was aware of and I know he had access to. There's no excuse for a man who was the former National Security Advisor, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the current Secretary of State. There is a process involved in taking intelligence, vetting intelligence, and packaging it for presentation. This process was not followed through. This was a con game from day one, and there's no way Colin Powell could have not known what he was doing. I just have to state that. In terms of talking, I only talked to Clinton's staff, none of the other people.
Thank you very much.
Brian, did you have anything? Okay.
Hi. Thank you for being here, and thanks to the fellow humans in the room who are here, too. Given the legal ramifications that you talked about, and as well as matters of my personal relationship to conscience and my investment in being a conscientious objector and wanting to manifest the reality of that in my life, because I believe I'm drafted. Right now, I believe that I am personally drafted, that every person in this room is drafted. Every person in this room who pays taxes is drafted. If we are willing to pay, we are complicit. And I don't want to be complicit anymore. And I've taken a position to live below the poverty line to do that, to not pay taxes. And someday maybe I'll be able to put that to more matters of test. But I am working with a body of Quakers who are making an effort to make it their business to not pay taxes for war. And I wonder what your thoughts are on my legal rights, given the legal ramifications you discussed about this war, as an extension on what I might use in making that clear that I am not going to pay taxes. I like to pay taxes for something other than illegal things and war. So
that's your question. Okay. Does anybody?
Well, just in the same way that if I were a doctor and you stood up and asked me about a medical problem that you had, I can't give you legal advice. I'm not even a member of the bar anymore. I don't practice law. And so I'm not here as somebody who could individually counsel any particular person.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Over here at this mic, we're going
to. I just wanted to thank you for your sacrifice. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, people don't make the connection that cutting the funding will end the war. And one way to do that is to not pay your taxes.
Great. Okay, over here. Again, short questions. We've got just about 2 or 3 minutes more, so we're going to try to get you all in.
I'll make it quick. This is a constitutional law question, so I'm addressing it to Elizabeth, even though you're probably the first lawyer I've ever liked, so...
You've ever what?
I've ever liked the first lawyer. I go back to Vietnam, the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which led me over to Vietnam, and we're finding out that was fabricated. The War Powers Act and all these things seem to be subterfuging Congress's responsibility in declaring war, Article 1, Section 8. It is Congress's obligation and duty. And somehow or other, the executive has stolen that away.
Right.
And I hold these people right here just as culpable as President Bush. Mm-hmm. What legal ramifications do they have to stop the war? I mean, just saying that they agreed to something that was fabricated and deceitful doesn't take them away from the responsibility to end it.
No. Clearly, in every sense, they have abdicated their responsibility, and they are not following their oaths in the Constitution. And you're right. Article 1, Section 8 gives them the responsibility to oversee foreign affairs and to tax and spend. And that gets to the issue of the money. I really think the best way to go after this whole issue has to do with the money. And in one sense... it's really inarguable, no matter what party you're in, that we should at the very least be able to know how much money is being spent on this war. So I think that would be a good question to ask Representative Kuhl. You know, what are you doing about that? Are you making sure that they're telling us what we're spending? But you're right. We haven't had Congress really declare a war for a very, very long time, right? Yeah.
Anybody else? Brian? Okay.
All my answers seem to be short. I just wanted to say that the Marine Corps did teach me a few things, and a lot of them went against the Marine Corps. But I say to that is judge a person by their actions, not by their words.
Okay. Yes, thank you. I'm directing this to Brian. I'm a veteran Marine myself, and my question is, do you feel that the rapid rotation or the rapid redeployment of troops is an effort or part of an effort to keep the troops out of the public view so that they cannot tell their stories to the public? We don't see the veterans from the Iraq and Afghanistan war in quite the same way we saw the veterans from the Vietnam War be able to speak early.
I'd have to say, first off, no. I don't think it's the deployment rotation. I don't think that's the tactic they're using. I think it's more direct, such as not allowing access to media outlets, such as the internet or phones, screening. One fantastic thing about being involved with other veterans after I got out was I was able to find out information from many different job positions throughout the military and found out to some disheartening that all our conversations, one form or another, are being screened. I myself never encountered anyone being charged with that, with any type of things like that. But to know that all we're being watched internally by our own people, basically for speaking out, is I think that's what you're talking about, not the deployment rotation. The deployment rotation is because they are trying to maintain troop levels and a facade of power in the region that is just not possible.
Anybody else? No? Okay.
Thank you. Peace to all of you. Thank you for everything. I have my own question, but someone handed me this. I was wondering if, Kathy, you would want to write it after I'm finished.
Okay.
My question is, according to the Constitution, if the the enemy is either foreign or domestic, and it seems that there's a consensus that some of the enemies are domestic, and none of them are here represented either, at what if the people who are writing the rule of law are primarily motivated by the accumulation of wealth and power, by some form of either slavery or war, then isn't the rule of law, according to them, essentially meaningless?
Not sure if that's really a constitutional question as much as a sort of philosophical, political question. But I think that when you look at the behavior of the politicians and the fact that people from both sides of the aisle get all these huge amounts of money from the defense and military complex, clearly they are not carrying out their oath of office in a way that is for the benefit of the country, for the benefit of the United States. They're carrying it out for their own benefit, and that is it's basically corruption.
Again, Ron. Okay, Judy?
Just real quick. First of all, Scott, you're talking about how you you told Hillary Clinton's staff the facts, and you told other people the facts. And if you look at the laws, it doesn't look like there's any chance that anyone would have actually read them when they voted on them, at least not in their totality. So I'm wondering, like, is there any redress we have against Congress? Because while we're asking them to impeach the executive and they're refusing, like, essentially, aside from voting, which is a long, slow process, is there any way, does anyone know if there's any other way to confront them? Because it seems like the people who actually have the information don't even have enough power to see that it's heard. It's probably, I don't know.
Constitution gives the American people a lot of rights, but only one power. That's power to vote. And as long and frustrating a process it is, that's what we got. That's the way we redress wrongs on the part of our elected officials. There is no immediate solution. The bottom line is if you've elected someone to office and they're not acting in a manner which you deem to be representing your will, you vote them out of office and you're organized to get them out of office. And that's the bottom line. That's the only language politicians understand, is the language of the vote. And if you seek to try and find a shortcut to that, you'll seek in frustration, because at the end of the day, on election day, it's who's got the most votes who holds the office. And if you don't want them, if you're not happy, you need to make sure they don't get enough votes.
This is also thanks to Shalom Keller exposing me to the, I believe, Constitution. Oh, no, this is actually the Declaration of Independence, stating that you, if you feel like your government is committing heinous and egregious crimes, you should rise up against them. It's, look it up. I didn't believe it myself. I'm pretty sure we have a copy of the Constitution at our table.
I can understand that those who were complicit in voting for this war might not want to hold accountable the president or the vice president through impeachment proceedings. But how does someone like Representative Slaughter, who has a progressive record, do you have any insight into what is going on in the minds of those who even voted against the war, that they will not hold this administration accountable, will not put impeachment on the table?
Well, I can only really speculate, but what I think is that the Democrats have decided that if they pursue impeachment, first of all, it will embarrass many of them. And second of all, they believe, I think, that it's a bad strategy in terms of getting a Democratic president elected. I actually don't think it is a bad strategy. I think the best thing that they could do is to come out swinging about this war and not hold back for a second. But I do think that's what's going on.
I mean, I've never sat down and talked with any of our senators or congressmen or representatives, but I do know that money influences them. And there's a lot of money to be made from this war, and that means there's a lot of influence going towards them.
Can I give the answer?
Pardon?
Can I give the answer? They're waiting. They're waiting till this next election because they're going to want to take over Congress. They want to end the Senate so that then I know from people that I've spoken with who are running for national office that that's the case because once they have the united front there, they'll be able to pass through all of the motions that we want. But my question is for Scott. I had like a deja vu feeling every time I see a general or a spokesman for the military tell me that we now have weapons of like armor-piercing weapons that are being made in Iran. And it sort of makes me think, does this sound familiar? You know, they're now trying to swing to Iran. So I guess I want to ask from your point of view, is there any way that they could actually make a case, like it sounds like they're trying to do, for us to go over to Iran?
They've already made the case, and they've won. I don't know if you quite understand it, but there are no constitutional impediments to this president going to war against Iran.
Really?
Every time Congress has made any attempt, the Democrats in Congress have shot it down. Nancy Pelosi refused to allow specific riders on funding bills that would prohibit the president from using American taxpayers' money to fund military action against Iran, citing that it would tie the president's hands and damage the national security interests of Israel. She actually said that. Here's a woman who put the Constitution on the ground and stepped on it in the name of the national security interests of another country. The U.S. Senate, including the wonderful Hillary Rodham Clinton, voted basically to pass a resolution that constitutes a target list, calling the Revolutionary Guard Command a terrorist organization, language specific to two existing war powers resolutions authorizing the use of force. There is nothing to stop this president from going to war in terms of the legislative branch or the Constitution. The only thing that stops his president is the fact that he has so badly broken our military that he needs to find the conditions in which, you know, he could justify this action. But I view what we've done with Iran. We've demonized that nation and its leadership, and we've hyped up the threat. You know, those explosively formed projectiles that are so sophisticated only the Iranians can make them.
Oh.
I learned how to make them in 1986 at the JFK Special Warfare School. Our job was to be able to teach stupid German farmers how to, you know, I say that not because all German farmers are stupid, but because this was a simple weapon. You take a tube, you put high explosive in it, you pound out a copper concave shape, put it in there, stick it on the ground with a fuse. When an armored tank comes by, you blast it. Wow. And it's supposedly so sophisticated only the Iranians can do it. And yet a week after we announced it, we raided a warehouse in western Baghdad controlled by Sunni non-Iranian affiliated militias who were making it in a former automotive garage, made in Iraq by Sunnis. It's ludicrous. But the point is, Iran has been demonized to the extent that the American people will accept at face value without question anything put out there that's negative about Iran. It's the same trap we fell into regarding Iraq. It's a very, very dangerous situation we live in.
Thank you.
Don?
Thank you, everyone up there. Scott, this is a question for you. It could be the internet or the strategy that brought us into Iraq illegally, but I can't help but see this nefarious underworld of a network of intelligence world intelligence agencies working and somewhat corrupted in bringing us into the state we're in. And, you know, as we act overtly and try and go to our congresspeople and talk about the rule of law, we see these, you know, our own intelligence agencies never really being held culpable for illegal acts that we have evidence that they've committed. And just as somebody who's been an insider in one intelligence area and seems to know a bit about maybe the weapons trade, I mean, how do you perceive this world? Is this this covert world that we can eventually bring to the surface? And how much influence do they have?
First of all, let's break it down into two aspects. The intelligence community is populated by men and women of honor, men and women who have volunteered to serve our nation in some of the most difficult missions possible. Mm-hmm. And we owe them a deep gratitude because they have truly made us safer. They have done amazing things in the name of the security of the United States of America. Unfortunately, they are part of a process that has been politicized for some time now. And you'll see that there are many frustrated intelligence professionals because they do believe in the notion of truth and finding truth and doing the right thing. Someday the story will come out about the men who carried out the waterboarding and what happened to them. They're not going to disappear. They did the horrible things because they believed they had to do them in the name of their country. They questioned it from day one. They challenged it, said, do we really need to do this? And then they were pressured into doing it, and they did it, and it destroyed them. This is the truth about the people. And it's not as though these people are bloodthirsty thugs that are going out to do bad things. There are those. Of course, you'll find that in any organization. But the intelligence community is populated by professionals who want to do the right thing, but because of the politicization of intelligence, can't. The problem isn't the men and women on the front line. The problem are the politicians at the top who disregard intelligence when it's inconvenient to the policies that they want to pursue. You know, when you throw a net into the water, you're going to catch a lot of fish. And the problem is we have politicians who are going to disregard 90% of the catch to make a point based upon 10% of the evidence. That's where the problem stands. The corruption is at the top. A fish stinks from its head. And in this case, the head is the intelligence leadership and the politicians they serve, not the brave men and women who are doing a very difficult job under very difficult circumstances.
Last question.
Did you have another talk with the former Secretary of Defense, Rumsfeld, when about 6 or 8, maybe a year into the war, he said, we don't know where the WMDs are now, but we know where they were. They were between Tikrit and Baghdad, or someplace to the north, south, east, or west of there, somewhat.
I actually have met Donald Rumsfeld, and when I resigned in 1998, he sent me a very nice letter. This was, of course, at the time when I was bashing Bill Clinton. And it was a great letter. It's a personal letter. It calls me a great American hero, that I've done great things for my country. Thank you for speaking truth to power. And if there is ever anything I can ever do to be of assistance to you, please do not hesitate to contact. Now, I did reach out at that time and tried to contact Donald Rumsfeld. Strangely enough, the personal phone number he left at the bottom of the letter wasn't answering.
And that was the voice of former Chief UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter, speaking as part of a town hall on the legality of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The event was held March 6, 2008, in Rochester, New York. Thanks to John Kievert of the First Unitarian Church of Rochester for recording the event, with assistance from Michelle Markert. And to unwelcome guest Rochester correspondent Carl Pultz of Alembic Productions for production and editing. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Rich will come down.